Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is October 5th, 2018, and this is episode 106. Politicoast is the BC Politics Podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us, including Spotify now. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast. Can't actually find us on SoundCloud anymore, because we've moved from there. But that's how we get on Spotify, so it's better.
I'm Scott DeLambeum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. And today we're joined again by...
Shannon Waters.
Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we begin, one of the things a lot of people keep asking us on Twitter, because I keep forgetting to put it into the actual show, like a good stealer of content would do, the intro music you hear or have been hearing for a while is Sergei Plotnikov's British Columbia, a 1972 folk song that you can find in obscure corners of the internet and nowhere else. On today's show, we'll be talking with you about the first week back in the legislature, even though they're going on holiday again next week, the LNG file, the, I don't know, US MCA deal, and some quick takes as usual. First off, as always, we're in partnership with BC Today, which you work for, Shannon.
Yes, I do.
British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for your free trial to get unique coverage delivered to the inbox every morning. Listeners, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca.
Reminder, we'll be hosting a PR debate put on by the Canadian Club on October 23rd at the Terminal City Club from 11:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Be between Suzanne Anton and Seth Klein. Tickets are available at the link we'll have in the show notes. Ticket price does include a lunch. I think we forgot to mention that the last couple times. So you will be getting fed, and it does make the value a little more reasonable. Tickets are $85 for listeners of the show, but please email and let them know that you are a listener so you can get the discount.
And in November, I don't have the details in front of me, but I'm going to be on Vancouver Podfest doing a panel on politics. So I'll put more information about that out soon, but do check out the Vancouver Podcast Festival, which sounds like it's the whole theme is murder podcasts. So a politics panel is very out of place, but I'm going to be there with Charlie Demers and Alex DeBoer from CITR's speaking office. It's going to be a very left-wing podcast.
You could, there's got to be something from like when someone was assassinated.
Ooh, we can make them.
Well, didn't a famous politician get gunned down on Sparks Street in Ottawa? Darcy McGee or something?
Roller Girl, who's running for mayor, has been convicted and served time for manslaughter. And apparently another candidate, I think even Fred Harding, was talking about how he's killed someone who was in ISIS during his time. So these things collide all the time. Let's throw it over to you, Shannon. It's our first segment, your first week back. How was the legislature this week?
It was fun. We were off. We weren't off. The House didn't sit for 4 months. It adjourned at the end of May, and we just went back in on the 1st of October. So there was a big, long break in there where not much was going on in the legislature. So it was interesting to go back. They installed new red carpets. Everything is very plush and cushy and not quite as threadbare as the carpets they had in there before.
Has anyone done an FOI on the cost of those carpets?
Not yet. They kind of kept us busy this first week, but I would say it's money well spent. Consider if you had seen the carpets that were in there before, I think you would agree with me. I think they got their money's worth out of the previous carpets. So, and we hit the ground running. We had legislation introduced right away on Monday, which is unusual aside from the normal bill, an act to ensure the supremacy of Parliament, which really doesn't go anywhere. And then on Tuesday, of course, we got the LNG announcement. We had both some very colorful and energetic question periods and one uncharacteristically kind of conciliatory and somber one while the opposition grilled the government about its action on the opioid crisis, the overdose crisis. So yeah, we've been keeping busy, and I have to say I'm liking standing around in the hallways again, just waiting for the ministers to walk by. I think people would be surprised how much time we spend standing around waiting to talk to ministers on a given day.
What were the bills that were introduced this week?
Well, we had some very significant ones, and then we had Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act number 3, which addresses, these come out, there's usually a couple of them every session, and they address administrative errors or typos. They make corrections, basically, to existing pieces of legislation. So we had one of those introduced. We've had, so probably the two most significant at the moment are the Opioid Damages and Healthcare Costs Recovery Act, Bill 38. That was introduced by Attorney General David Eby on the very first day of this fall session. And what that legislation is going to do is it's going to kind of enable the government to pursue its class action lawsuit against opioid manufacturers and distributors. So the government has introduced a similar bill to this one way back, I believe it was about 20 years ago in the late 90s, when it sued tobacco manufacturers, again, for the healthcare costs that their product places on the province's healthcare system. The Attorney General is hopeful that this new act or this new lawsuit won't drag out as long as the previous one did. It is as yet unresolved 20 years later. But he did acknowledge in talking to reporters that these things sort of take time. So there's Bill 38, the Opioid Damages and Healthcare Costs Recovery Act. We also had our Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction introduced the Poverty Reduction Strategy Act. This is something else we've been waiting for this session. It was introduced on October 2nd. And Bill 39, I believe Minister Simpson described it as a commitment document. There's not really a whole lot of substance to it because the province isn't going to release its poverty reduction plan until the spring session. But what the legislation does is it commits the government to enacting this plan at some point in the future. It has to introduce it before the end of March next year. And it sets some targets for how much the government is going to try and reduce poverty by over the next, I believe it's a 5-year term that they're looking at the moment. We also had the Attorney General introduce Bill 40, the Electoral Reform Referendum 2018 Amendment Act. This is another enabling piece of legislation, and what it does is it addresses the government's commitment in the bill they introduced last fall to take us into the electoral reform referendum that's happening next month. The government introduced a bill, and in that bill, it committed to holding another referendum if voters choose to change the voting system. So if PR is a go, and we have our first election in 2021 under the new PR system, this bill will require the government, or should require the government, to hold another referendum on electoral reform after two election cycles. So potentially, say, 2025, if the elections stick to the schedule. And we would have another referendum and voters would get to decide whether we're going to stay with the current, with the PR system, or whether we're going to switch back to first past the post because everything is a mess. So that piece of legislation has also been introduced. And then we had the Land Statutes Amendment Act, which I don't know how many people would find interesting, but it basically is going to make it easier to file like land transfers and other documents related to land.
I see Scott nodding along and getting very excited.
They'll be able to do it all electronically, so make it more efficient and supposedly more secure and all that kind of stuff. That bill actually had a lot of discussion around it and is being sent back to the drafters after, I believe it was Green Party MLA Adam Olson identified some kind of unclear language within it. And that doesn't happen all that often. Two of the bills have already been passed, actually. They have not yet been given royal assent, but they've gone through sort of the legislative process. That's the Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act and the Opioid Damages and Healthcare Cost Recovery Act. So the government is moving quite quickly compared to previous sessions when it comes to legislation. But we've been told by both the Premier and by Government House Leader Mike Farnworth that they basically have more legislation than they have days in the legislative calendar, where the House is only scheduled to sit until the end of November. So it sounds like there's going to be quite a bit of legislation being pushed through in the next few weeks.
Well, and the big one I think we're all waiting for is the speculation tax and figuring out what that looks like. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a little surprising to me that, like, I get that these are three, the three you mentioned are kind of signature policies, but they're also in a way, kind of symbolic. Like the Poverty Reduction Strategy Act is like a plan to have a plan to eventually get around to it, which I think disappointed a lot of people. And even the electoral reform referendum or second referendum, they probably could have put that piece of legislation off until after we knew if we needed it.
Well, you probably want it on the books before the vote actually happens, so you don't have the people going around saying, oh, it's a sham, they're promising this, but they won't follow through.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also something that a new government could just repeal.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is that the NDP is kind of doing sort of its due diligence and living up to its commitment, but depending on what government is sitting in the House by the time we get past that first PR referendum, if that is where we go, yeah, they can just get rid of it.
So are we expecting things like that speculation tax bill to come like shortly after the Thanksgiving break? Or do you have no clue?
Well, here's the thing. We don't really know. Eventually, like, we'll often sort of try to get a feel for what kind of legislation the government is planning to introduce. And sometimes with the larger pieces, like, for instance, with the opioid bill that was introduced this week, we kind of got a heads up, or there was word going around that they were going to be introducing it in the morning, but there's not a lot of notice. The government tends to play its cards very close to its chest when it comes to legislation. This is something I've been trying to change. It was one of the first things I did when I got into the House in September, because my boss, Allison, who writes Queen's Park Today out in Toronto, or did, we now have Sabrina Nanji doing the reporting out there, but Allison would get a legislative sort of calendar each week from the government. It was given to the press gallery, just saying, you know, we're planning to introduce this bill during the morning session, and then we'll debate these bills in the afternoon on Monday, and then just sort of same thing for every day that they were sitting in the House. And of course, it's subject to change depending on what happens, but it just kind of gives those who are interested in the legislative process an idea of the government's priorities and what kind of time they're planning to allocate to bills during the week. And I have gotten no traction out here in BC. We don't have anything like that. We have apparently never had anything like that. And the government has expressed very little interest in changing that so far. I am planning to follow up again. I haven't had time because this week ended up being so busy, but I am planning on following up with the government House Leader's Office and seeing if they might be seeing things differently during this fall session, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Let's pivot a bit to kind of where the opposition's sitting with respect to these bills. How have they responded to what the government's introduced?
Well, we had not a whole lot of debate around the Opioid Damages and Healthcare Cost Recovery Act, which, probably not surprising, both sides of the House recognize that there is a crisis going on and we kind of need to do everything we can. There was some opposition to this bill. Liberal Party leader Andrew Wilkinson, when the legislation was introduced, had said, you know, we'll see about supporting it, but our concern is people are dying right now, and this legislation is unlikely to bear fruit for possibly decades. So some people kind of see it as a bit symbolic. There's actually a lot of discussion around the Miscellaneous Statutes Amendment Act. I found that kind of interesting, especially because the MLAs have to stand up and say what an honor it is to speak, like, in favor of this bill. That literally just corrects, like, typos and, you know, like, unclear language. So that's always kind of fun.
So is that a actual requirement by, like, the stand orders, or is this just general parliamentary theater?
I am not sure, but I would lean towards they have to say, I don't know if they have to use the word honor, but every time they stand up, they have to address the speaker and basically say, like, thank you, I'm so glad I got to talk about this bill. So depending on what the bill is, that can be kind of amusing. We haven't had any debate yet on either the poverty reduction, or we did have some debate on the poverty reduction strategy. It was given second reading on Thursday and discussed in the afternoon. And there's a lot of differences between the way the government wants to approach this issue of poverty and the way the BC Liberal Party sees the way the government should help get people out of poverty, which is mostly by creating jobs. So there is a difference of opinion here, I think. And you're likely going to see sort of the NDP and the Greens vote in favor of it and the Liberals vote against it. Ellis Ross actually stood up and gave a beautiful speech in the House on Thursday about poverty on reserve and his experiences and why he doesn't think that the government's bill is going to do enough. So that was interesting. Actually, Thursday was a really great day for speeches. Just kind of a sidebar here, but NDP MLA Bowen Ma stood up and talked about Me Too and sort of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and was really very eloquent and spoke very powerfully, I think, to what a lot of women have been experiencing in the past couple of weeks. So that was nice to see.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to mention that. So thanks for being spontaneous.
Yeah, I don't normally tweet the statements that MLAs make in the House, but I did feel the need to do that with Bowen's speech. So if anybody's listening to this and hasn't either read it or seen the video, you can find both of those on my Twitter feed. I don't know if the Liberals are going to say much about the Electoral Reform Referendum Act. They certainly don't support electoral reform, but whether they support there being a referendum in case voters do choose to go to PR remains to be seen.
I wonder if they'd almost use it just as a chance to grandstand more about electoral reform. It seems like they want to put a lot of effort into fighting that this fall.
I think so. It hasn't come up yet in question period, which surprised some people and didn't surprise others. Those who thought the Liberals were likely to bring it up in question period, you know, they've been talking a lot about how the public needs to be made aware of this referendum, to be educated about the options in this referendum. Question period's not really a great place to educate people about stuff, although it can be immensely entertaining. And as has been pointed out to me by several MLAs, not a lot of people read Hansard or follow question period.
Imagine.
So I'll do a plug for Hansard because those guys are great. I spend a lot of time reading the blues. And if you're ever bored and feel like reading some great political theater that is occasionally just dripping with scorn and sarcasm and colorful language, I believe the premier said something about converts on the road to Damascus during this week's question periods. Reading Hansard can be great. And they do also pull out a video of question period itself. So you can just watch that, if that's your thing.
I know when I interviewed Kennedy Stewart for Canby Report, he mentioned that his habit when he was in Parliament was to slip in the names of punk rock bands into as many speeches as he could, whether it was Dead on Arrival or whatever else he could.
Well, the Premier had another, related to bands, he referenced Steel Wheels in question period, but he mistakenly attributed it to the Eagles at first. And so at the end of question period, Premier John Horgan stood up and made sure that everybody knew that he knew that Steel Wheels was the Rolling Stones and not the Eagles.
Was it a formal apology to the House?
No, it was not.
So you mentioned question period, and those are some of the sort of jokey highlights. What have the Liberals and Greens been on if they're not focused on electoral reform?
Well, the Liberals are very, very much focused on the Community Benefits Agreement, which they have taken to calling the Union Benefits Agreement. That has been the bulk of their questions for this week so far. I believe aside from the day we were talking about the overdose crisis, all of their questions except for one have been on that subject. That's not uncommon. They often do sort of pick a topic and stick to it. And when we were talking on Shane's show this morning, Keith used the word chippy to kind of describe the Liberals' attitude in the House. There was a lot of heckling on Thursday. Claire Trevena, our transportation minister, at one point just like stood there for a while, and then the speaker told her to sit down for a bit while they just kind of waited for the Liberals to run themselves out of gas heckling. So it seems like they're maybe finally sort of finding their feet as opposition. I've used that phrase before in my writing, but yeah, and really kind of realizing that they can be more aggressive in criticizing the government and holding them to account, and that one of the places they can be the most aggressive is during question period.
Well, looking forward, they're off next week, but kind of what's can we expect for the rest of the session?
Well, as Ian pointed out, we are waiting on the speculation tax. There will also likely be legislation related to bringing back the Human Rights Commission. We've had a report on that as well. There's going to be more legislation to deal with lobby reform, possibly some more on money laundering aspects. David Eby kind of foreshadowed that a little bit the government addressing more recommendations made by Peter German in his Dirty Money report, even as he's now been launched on another investigation into real estate, luxury cars, and horse racing. Be interesting to see what that one brings to us when it comes out sometime around March. One of the things we are almost certainly not going to see legislation on, which everybody was kind of waiting for this fall, is the climate plan. Environment Minister George Heyman told reporters this week that the government isn't planning to introduce that plan until the very end of the session, and possibly not even until the House rises at the end of November, so it might come out in December. We're not going to see any legislation related to the LNG project that's been announced. That's according to senior government officials. The government might look at introducing needed legislation in the spring. Then again, Rob Shaw of the Vancouver Sun had a sit down with the premier this week, and Horgan told him that they're potentially looking at a way to get away with this LNG deal to bring the industry to BC without introducing any legislation, if possible. So we'll see.
It's a tough balancing. I can tell that they're clearly trying to like keep the Greens on side, but delaying the climate plan seems like a good way to really annoy Andrew Weaver.
Yeah, I mean, when I interviewed him as sort of the week, you know, preview going into the fall session, and that was what he talked about for this. You know, they're going to see what the government does with the speculation tax. Weaver says the Greens have already drafted their own version of sort of, or their response to a speculation tax bill, which would basically empower municipalities to levy a vacancy tax if they so choose. The idea was a proposal at the Union of BC Municipalities. It was actually proposed by a community in Weaver's own riding, Oak Bay, and received unanimous support at the Union of BC Municipalities meeting. So the Greens apparently drafted that and given it to the NDP. I suspect Weaver will introduce it around the time the government introduces its speculation tax. He wouldn't tell me how many private members' bills he's planning to introduce this fall. The man is very prolific when it comes to legislation, So I was curious. But it sounds like he's maybe shifting his focus a little bit. And instead of introducing all these private members' bills, none of which go anywhere, most of them never even make it past first reading. He's had one that apparently might go to committee stage. It's been given second reading, but he's hopeful it'll go to committee stage. So it looks like Weaver might be shifting and sort of focusing on drafting amendments to the government's legislation and trying to improve on what the government is trying to do rather than introducing sort of his own legislation as if he were a member of the opposition, which the Greens sit on the same side of the House as the government in the chamber, and the Liberals all sit on the other side. So when you're watching question period or if you're watching proceedings in the House, it very much looks like the Greens are on the government side and not in opposition. So.
Well, it's not a bad strategy for the Greens to try to do the amendment route, because if they can get the Liberals on side, they can, which was what we all talked about, I think, in the summer of chaos, they can pass these amendments and change the agenda. But instead, they've kind of just gone along with everything the NDP's wanted to do, which is fine for Horgan, but I can imagine has sort of irked Wilkinson and...
It has, yeah. And Wilkinson uses very strong language to talk about Andrew Weaver these days and the way he sort of just carries water for the government in a way. And you're right, I think it does really work well for the NDP. But the other thing is, and the general perception is that the Greens will not do anything until we're through this referendum because they want proportional representation to pass. They would benefit from it. They would have more representation in the House. And so until the referendum is a settled question, the Greens don't really have any way. Well, they have a way, but they're not likely to do anything to endanger sort of their alliance with the government or let the government fall.
Yeah, it's a pretty high risk strategy to push back against the government so strongly that it might fall at this point.
Yeah, it's a gamble. So once the referendum is over, who knows? If we're going to a PR system, the legislation still says that it would only apply to an election in 2021, which means that if the government falls before that, I don't know what happens, actually. Should probably look into that at some point, because it does say in the legislation that it would be for the first scheduled election, which would be in November of 2021. If it doesn't pass, then the Greens kind of have a decision to make, and they may end up playing hardball with the government instead of sort of trying to preserve the current status quo in the legislature.
So that alternative to the speculation tats that Weaver's talking about introduced, would this be basically just modeled on the Vancouver empty homes tats and applying that to the rest of the province?
It sounds like it. Weaver believes that municipalities should have similar powers to Vancouver and be able to enact their own vacancy tax if they feel that there is an issue in their rental market. He believes that municipalities sort of know their situation better than maybe the provincial government does. And he did point out to me that there are some areas in the province that have very low rental vacancy rates, including, say, Whistler, that are not currently included in the speculation tax. And this would allow them to sort of opt in to that. But it would also allow communities where there are rental issues who have expressed an opposition to the tax, like, say, West Kelowna, to back out. So, and it will still be a private member's bill, but if the Liberals decide to get behind it and the NDP decide for whatever reason to let debate proceed on it, could be interesting. I'm unclear as to whether either the Liberals or the Greens would propose some kind of amendment to the government speculation tax bill that would maybe add that in. The Liberals, probably not. Wilkinson has said, you know, he doesn't want to add to the pile of taxes that the NDP are just heaping on British Columbians. And a vacancy tax would be another tax for some parts of the province. But we haven't seen the legislation yet. Apparently the government is reviewing it. It's not appeared on the order paper at this point in time, I don't believe. So I do not know what the timeline could be on that bill.
Well, sounds like it's going to be a busy session. We'll have to keep checking in with you and reading BC Today, I guess, to keep track of what's going on.
Moving on to segment two, this is the good pipeline.
Based on the coverage, you would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so the BC government and Dutch Royal Shell basically put out a big announcement this week saying that the long talked about LNG project will finally actually happen. This is a $40 billion investment, I believe, up in Kitimat, and involves a pipeline from northeast BC to Kitimat.
It's a really interesting project. It was one of the first things we talked about, I think, on our first episode, or that was Patronus.
One of the first three, I think.
Yeah, that was Patronus, but this is sort of a similar project, I believe. Maybe it's actually a different one. Anyway, LNG has been talked about in this province for so long. The Liberals spent so much political capital on it and got it close, and then prices dropped and they couldn't do it. And then prices kind of came back and the NDP went, well, what if we give even more concessions? And now we have LNG.
Or we will have LNG.
Or we will.
I think they're saying they're expecting the project to be productive by 2023 or 24 at this point in time. Yeah, Tuesday was an interesting morning. I went to bed with no idea. On Monday, I went to bed with no idea of when LNG was going to be announced, other than that it was going to be before Friday. And I woke up on Tuesday morning to see that the government had sent out a media advisory after 11 p.m. on Monday to let us know that at 8:30 a.m. there was going to be an announcement in Vancouver about LNG.
That seems odd, especially because like this Bloomberg had a story on Sunday about a big investment into BC LNG, so I'm surprised they were waiting so long to decide to hold the press conference.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. But yeah, they did. So we got word late on Monday night, and then fairly early on Tuesday morning, they had this big smiley announcement in Vancouver. I'm not sure I've ever seen so many like smiling guys in suits before. But what was really interesting about the announcement was, and I'll have to look at the pictures and count, but I think there may have actually been more Liberal MLAs there than there were NDP MLAs. So the premier attended, of course. John Horgan was there, and our Energy, Mines, and Petroleum Resources Minister, Michelle Mongal. Andrew Wilkinson was there, the leader of the official opposition, as well as Mike Bernier, who represents Peace River South and is the party's oil and gas critic, so that makes sense. And Ellis Ross, who is their critic for LNG and Resource Opportunities, I believe is his title. He also represents the Skeena riding, which is where Kitimat is. And as a former counselor with the Haisla Nation, he's a leader of the Haisla, he's worked on the file for a really long time as well. So that was sort of a gracious gesture, I guess, by the government. Also, Rich Coleman was there. He'd worked very hard on the file as well when the Liberals were trying to bring LNG in. And so was former Premier Christy Clark, was also at the announcement and in the pictures. Very conspicuously absent was Andrew Weaver and any of the Green MLAs, but not really surprising in that. Yeah, so this was actually, Horgan mentioned that he says he went through Hansard and the first time LNG gets mentioned is in 1982, which was further back than I sort of thought. But yeah, BC's been chasing the LNG dream for a long time, and now it is set to come true.
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, Andrew Weaver and the Greens are very grumpy about it, but the press has been surprisingly positive, like across the board. As you mentioned, Christy Clark put out this like Facebook video as well saying how happy she is to see her like biggest life goal, I guess, accomplished.
But definitely political goal.
Yeah, like,
yeah. I mean, people are talking about it as her political legacy, that, you know, she sort of laid the foundation, her government laid the foundation for this project. I believe in her tweet she said it was the best day of her professional life or something like that. So obviously very pleased.
She must have also been very pleased after the Site C. She's just getting all the things, just not with the responsibilities. The amount of work done on this project to get every First Nation along the route on side almost like shows the contrast with the Trans Mountain Pipeline, where the government was doing that until the end when they kind of fell down on the job. And this contrast, I think, is very interesting to show that if you're on the we need big projects to go through in Canada, this shows that it's not impossible. It might be hard, and it might take, I guess,
6 years, is it, at least?
Oh, if it's 1982.
Well, this torrent push.
Yeah, it can take a long time, but you can get there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really stood out to me in watching the announcement was Haisla Chief Counselor Crystal Smith said that this project, LNG Canada, had set a new standard for Indigenous consultation. Because it is providing, like, the Haisla, and I believe it's the Haisla. Anyways, First Nations groups along the pipeline, they have economic benefit agreements. Their people are being trained to be able to obtain jobs on the pipeline and potentially on the finished product, although there will be a lot fewer jobs there than in the construction phase. And they are going to be prioritized in hiring. Like, it's not just consultation, there's like engagement, economically speaking, with the people whose land this pipeline will go through, which is not something that really seems to have happened with Trans Mountain, at least not to the same degree.
The, I guess, big challenge going forward now is how does the BC government, and to some extent the federal government, square this with the climate plans they're talking about, with the number of conservative governments coming up across the country. Trudeau's carbon tax plan is in a bit of trouble.
Well, the BC carbon tax plan is in a bit of trouble on this one too, because apparently it's just in hand waved away.
Yeah, so I know the government hasn't really announced anything on how they're going to make this climate plan work with this, you know, big project. Well, is it basically just they're trying to talk their way around it and we'll tell you later?
So it kind of got lost a bit in the shuffle, I think, also because a lot of the journalists were just kind of shell-shocked on Tuesday covering a story like LNG, like this LNG announcement is a lot. Like, there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of different sides to the issue. There's a lot of angles to cover. And so we had this announcement and there was some response from the Liberals, and we talked to Andrew Weaver, and then the government was like, oh, we're going to have this technical briefing for you and tell you about sort of the LNG industry and also how our climate plan is going to deal with these emissions. And the answer basically seems to be everything else is going to have to be electric, and then we'll just have this like LNG industry operating in BC. So
it's a good thing we're building a giant dam then, because apparently we're gonna need a lot of electricity.
Yes, but that is in no way is the decision to proceed with Site C directly linked to the government's courting of the LNG industry. That is quoting a senior government official.
Okay, so it's just coincidental that we're planning to electrify the entire province.
It's just a good, happy coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the government. And I have to say, sitting in this briefing was kind of exciting because this would be a huge shift. Like, with this climate plan, with these commitments, if the government does enact them, there will be a huge shift in the way the province is powered. And so far, the government is basically relying on electricity. We do get a lot of hydroelectricity here in BC, and Site C is going to provide us with more of that. But the other thing the government's talking about, and something that the premier has said, is that we're going to get, so of the $40 billion investment that everybody's talking about, BC is supposed to get about $23 billion over 40 years. And the government could use that money to sort of fund innovation and find new ways to use renewable energy sources so that, say, our transportation sector and people's homes are no longer heated with sort of gas or oil or even wood burning devices, of which there are a lot still in BC. And we do move on to other renewables as well as continuing sort of our use of hydroelectric. So it's sounding like it's going to be a very ambitious shift that the government needs to do, and it remains to be seen whether they can actually get there. I mean, as one of my colleagues pointed out, like, hydro rates right now are not cheap. You're actually better off, economically speaking, heating your home with natural gas, which of course doesn't help with the emissions, but it does help with your power bill. And so getting the average homeowner to switch from, say, natural gas to electric heat could be a bit of a tough sell. Now, the government has said they can incentivize. They actually launched a new incentive program for both businesses and homeowners, civilians, to be able to better insulate and sort of make their homes hold heat better, which is another good way of using less power, is if your home actually holds on to the heat that you generate within it. Like I said, it's a very ambitious plan, and it's going to be interesting to see how they get around to realizing it once we actually see what the plan itself is. This was just kind of a bit of a teaser, and specifically looking at, you know, the amount of emissions LNG is going to add to the province's carbon footprint, and so sort of how we need to reduce on every other front in order to meet the commitments that the government has set for itself.
For sure. And one of the other last things I just want to ask or sort of put out there on LNG is, I know the CCPA has been sort of questioning, I guess, that $40 billion number. And I just pulled up their policy note from this week, and they suggest that that number's pulled from the environmental assessment application, where that's like their high watermark for the largest version of the project. And in their most, I mean, you know, the CCPA leans left and doesn't like LNG, but they say this could realistically be a tenth of that. I mean, I don't know where the real number is, but do you see anyone else sort of questioning the $40 billion number or some of these proposed benefits? Or is it kind of just being taken at the government's word?
Yeah, not so far this week. I did read, I believe it was the CCPA economist talking to Star Metro in Vancouver and saying the same thing. Like, the $40 billion is like the maximum this project, like the maximum sort of economic benefit of this project, and that it involves at least two phases. And LNG Canada has only committed to the first phase so far, which at its maximum would only bear about half of those same economic benefits. So then we go down to somewhere around $20 billion. And some of that is going to be invested overseas because the federal government has waived steel tariffs. So certain modules required for this LNG project can be assembled overseas and then shipped here, and they won't be hit with the steel tariffs for those steel components. So it'll be interesting. It's one of those things where we're probably not going to know until it's all been built and is in working order. And that could be decades from now.
Well, I guess it's been decades in the making, and it'll be decades before we know if it pans out. But
yeah, it could be another 35 years or so.
Jobs are on the way for the North, which at least is some good news.
Yeah, it sounds like Kitimat is really pretty excited about what's going to be going on up there over the next few years.
I was going to say, you spent a lot of time in northern BC, and do you get the sense this is the kind of thing they're hugely behind?
Yes. They? Yes. Well, for certain, I was more in the center of the province, and I've spent some time in the east as well. The coast is absolutely beautiful. I've never been to Kitimat itself. But it was pointed out to us in this technical briefing that while most areas of the province have had their populations grow over the past sort of decade and a half, the area in which Kitimat sits saw its population decline by nearly 20% between 2001 and 2017. And that was because the LNG dream that everybody was talking about, the boom that was supposed to come, never arrived. And so people started to leave. And now, I guess some of them might be going back there. Other people are going to be arriving. And northeastern BC will also probably see a bit of a bump because that's where the gas fields are. So yeah, it will likely be good for the North, economically speaking.
All right. Well, we'll keep following that file. We'll move on now to our third segment as we get even more into policy depth as we go to talk about how you get to trade with the USMCA. The NAFTA deal is done, and the best joke I think I've heard, this is probably from the Beaverton, it's where I'm stealing all my jokes these days, is someone probably just crossed out NAFTA on the old agreement and wrote USMCA and gave it to Trump, and he was like, I love it. It's a new thing. It's so much better than the old one. Because it sounds like a lot of things didn't actually change.
Yeah, no, it's in some ways a very Trumpian policy to just kind of rebrand the thing that already exists.
So the biggest, I guess, win for Canada is we keep Chapter 19, the state dispute resolution thing that we had to Google in the middle of one previous episode on this. Everything else seems like tinkering around the edges. Nothing seems to make it a lot better. Some things, I think, maybe make it a little bit worse. There's an extension to copyright. So instead of copyright expiring 50 years after the death of a creator, it's now 70 years.
That's really don't change the incentive to write.
Actually, we're creating a podcast now, so we're copyright holders. So that maybe that's good for our future descendants.
Although, yes, they will get all of the dozens of dollars that this podcast is worth.
Although we've also put it up on a Creative Commons license, so that doesn't help us. It also extends the intellectual property for pharmaceuticals, so it'll be 2 more years, 10 instead of 8 for generic drugs to come out, which is a little bit more frustrating. I guess maybe good, maybe bad, depending on your perspective. We're locally going to get international wines in the, what is it, 4 grocery stores that sell wine?
Yeah, so that's it's been a long-standing complaint. So now you'll be able to buy California wine next to your BC wine in a grocery store. Now, since this is a international deal, I still don't think you can buy Ontario wine. So this will probably be yet another case where it's easier to trade with another country than across a provincial border.
Yeah, it's sounding very like it's kind of ridiculous that it is more difficult. I mean, currently in a liquor store, it's more difficult to get wine from outside of BC, but within Canada, than it is to get wine from like anywhere else around the world. And the changes that are being made in this USMCA will, of course, it's an international trade deal, so it does nothing for domestic trade. The premier basically said he doesn't think BC wines are going to have any problem at the grocery store sort of holding their own. Our wine is as good as, you know, what any other country makes, at least the other countries who were mad about us only selling BC wines in grocery stores. There were a few of them. I believe Australia, Argentina, maybe New Zealand had also joined in a WTO dispute that the states were also a part of about this discrimination at the grocery store.
The other big thing that was Canada's concession on supply management was this willingness to increase the market share for foreign dairy from 3.2% to 3.6%, which I think everyone kind of met with a giant shrug.
Well, no, the dairy industry said this was going to be ruinous, that 0.4% market share. Everybody else just shrugged.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some apparently concern on the part of dairy producers in BC as to what this is going to mean, how it is going to affect them. So our agriculture minister is working on that, and it's something that's on the premier's radar. Jobs minister Bruce Ralston spoke to reporters today in the House about that. His understanding is that the additional milk that comes in will likely be what is called industrial milk and is used to make other dairy products. So most of the milk that you actually drink will probably still be from Canada, but there will be some more sort of cheese that is made with American milk. Ralston likened it to the concessions or to the deal that Canada struck with the European Union when it came to dairy. And that didn't seem to be the end of the world for Canadian dairy producers. So probably this won't be either.
Oh, certainly it won't be.
I guess the result for Trudeau was always going to be status quo or worse, and it looks like he managed to get status quo.
Ish. Yeah, there's one clause that hasn't been talked about. I haven't seen a lot of dialogue about it around or in BC, but Ontario has apparently been discussing clause 32, which basically obligates Canada to give the United States a heads up anytime we try to make a trade deal with another country that is not part of the USMCA. And I guess that is of concern, particularly when it comes to China, because we do not currently have an explicit trade deal with China. And it's of a concern potentially for BC, because we've been doing a lot of diversification over the past few years, partly to try and stop being so dependent on the US market when it comes to softwood lumber. And China has been one of the countries that we have sort of been ramping up our trade with, particularly our exports. So that could be a wrinkle that rears its head at some point in time. But I haven't, like I said, I haven't heard a lot of discussion about it out here yet.
So the article we're looking at says they need to give a heads up for trade agreements with non-market countries. Is that?
Mm-hmm. I think that means not in this trade market.
Oh, not in this trade market.
I think the first time I read it, not a free market country.
Yeah, I read it as, you know, a nominally communist China would be out, but Europe would be fine. But I guess if it's non-market as in the common North American market, that might be different.
Yes, and I believe that's the interpretation that people are going with.
They should just have non-party or something on there. Be clearer.
Maybe they'll introduce a miscellaneous statutes bill at some point to fix all the typos and tighten up that language as well.
Well, that'll be another long, long negotiation. The reaction, you talked about a bit about the provincial reaction. At the federal level, Liberals were, I think, trying not to pat themselves on the back too much, lest they tip off Trump that they feel like they got a good deal, because then he would think he didn't, because everything's a zero-sum game to him. But the Conservatives went very negative, very fast for some reason. And I can't figure out their response to this.
Oh, it's typical. Everything Trudeau does is wrong.
I mean, Scheer's running around saying he could have gotten a better deal, but he had also said we should have capitulated like on day one.
Except on dairy, because that's apparently it. Okay, I was going to say sacred cow, but I'm not going to. But yeah, that's kind of the thing that he will not touch at all.
So, I don't know. I don't have a lot to say on this because it's...
I wish the steel tariffs are gone.
Yeah, that's actually something in there. There's some tariffs are gone, but some are weirdly still in effect.
Yeah, because that's the weird national security exemption they're still playing around with. And yeah, it's still in place, and like, I deal with them for work. And yeah, it's really annoying to have everything cost 25% more.
Yeah, and the tariffs on aluminum are also still an issue. That was something else that BC has its eye on, because we do have an aluminum smelter here in the province. And it's something that is on the jobs minister's radar that has yet to be negotiated. Ralston actually had some fairly colorful language around that. I believe he said something to the effect of these tariffs are completely unfair and totally lacking in any legal basis. So we'll see what happens on that front.
One question that maybe you know the answer to, and maybe not, but one of the things that is coming up fast, as we all know, is cannabis legalization. But that's been a contentious, I imagine, point between Canada and the U.S. Was this dealt with at all in the agreement?
Not to my knowledge, and in speaking with our Solicitor General, who's also the House Leader, Mike Farnworth, the province is concerned about people getting arrested at the border. At this point in time, I would basically say that if you work for anybody in the cannabis industry, just maybe don't plan to go to the U.S. for at least 6 months. The government is looking at ways to sort of deal with this. Of course, it's nothing the province can do because, you know, it is a border issue, so the powers fall to the federal government, but they are in dialogue with the feds to say, look, we need to make sure that people who are working in a legal industry here in Canada aren't getting lifetime bans when they try to go to the U.S.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have a feeling it's probably going to be January of 2021 before much action ends up happening on that.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was really weird to me to realize on Tuesday that we were literally 2 weeks away from legalization. Talking with Farnworth this week, he is confident that BC will have enough supply to meet the province's demand. He believes that there will be very considerable interest by British Columbians in purchasing legal cannabis. Unfortunately, unless you live in Kamloops, you will not be able to do so at a government store, nor will there be any private retailers actually up and running. But for those of us who don't live in Kamloops, you can buy online from the government, and products will be delivered very quickly to your home, according to the Solicitor General. However, if you are a fan of a particular strain of cannabis that might be very popular, you may need to sort of adjust your expectations around the availability. Farnworth was talking about, you know, when a small winery in the Okanagan blows, like a particular vintage blows up, and there's not a lot of supply and there's very high demand and you basically cannot get your hands on this particular wine. That may happen with certain strains of cannabis that are available through the government stores.
Please tell me you asked him for names of strains.
No, we didn't talk about names of strains. Von Palmer did grill him as to what sort of system of measurement will be used. Are we going to be talking about, like, keys of cannabis? We'll be using grams to deal with them. And the Solicitor General did not provide a specific amount that the province is planning to have available on legalization day. He just said he believes it will be sufficient.
Well, let's move on to Twit Tates. Andrew Wilkinson threw down the gauntlet earlier this week and challenged the Premier to debate him.
That was the story last week.
Was it last week?
Yeah, it was last week.
The update this week is, and I think this was even just today or yesterday, John Horgan said yes?
Well, it's kind of a qualified yes. I really liked Horgan's language. It made me kind of giggle a bit. He said, if Mr. Wilkinson still wants to go, I'm good with that. And he was kind of talking about, the Premier believes that we should wait until after the municipal elections to have this debate, if it is going to happen. And it seems that the focus on it is going to be raising awareness that, you know, this referendum is coming up. And so they want it to be broadcast as widely as possible so that as many British Columbians as possible see it. So that will involve media outlets around the province. And I guess they're just kind of talking about starting to get the ball rolling on when and where that debate might take place.
Well, I tweeted out on Twitter that we'll volunteer as tribute if they need someone to help, I don't know, get it out to
hundreds of people.
No, it should be a good thing. As we talked about last week, like, the idea of a debate's probably not going to change anyone's mind, but it is a good way to at least remind people this is happening. And it'll at least be entertaining for nerds like us.
Yes. Now, the question is whether or not Green Party leader Andrew Weaver is invited to participate. Andrew Wilkinson has indicated that he doesn't really care. I'm not sure about the Premier's thoughts on that. The question is, Do they want to make it basically like an all candidates debate where everybody gets to have their say? Or is it just yes, PR versus no PR, in which case you really only need the premier and the leader of the opposition there?
Well, hopefully we see that debate and have a good viewing party or something like that at a pub. One other news story that came up this week, sort of a flash from the past, is former New Democrat Member of Parliament Sven Robinson is back in the news because he's been hanging around Vancouver, his old home. For a long time, he'd been off in Switzerland working with some international health and AIDS charities, but he is leaking rumors, or rumors are swirling, that he might be considering challenging Terry Beach in the North Burnaby Seymour.
Burnaby North Seymour.
Whatever
I think
it's called. Terry Beach's riding in the next federal election, which would be a probably good news story for Jagmeet Singh, who's been losing a lot of members of parliament, and getting someone prominent like Sven Robinson back would be quite the coup.
Potentially. How old is Sven Robinson now?
Yeah, he's not the youngest chicken.
I mean, as somebody pointed out on Twitter, I think it was at the beginning of the week, like, politics so old. Our youngest MLAs are in their mid-30s. I believe Bowen Ma is the youngest one, and the number of gray heads in the chamber is considerable. And the same is true of federal politics as well. So, I mean, Robinson's a colorful character. He's certainly been typically very well regarded. A lot of people have a lot of respect and affection for him. So, yeah, I mean, it could make things interesting.
I looked it up. He's 66 years old.
Oh, okay.
So maybe he could have the Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders, but he's not even as old as them, I think.
No, definitely younger than Sanders.
I think younger than Corbyn, too.
Corbyn's 69. Mm. So, you know, there's some appetite among kids these days for uppity old socialists, and that was always Sven's approach. It would be good to see him back. I mean, he left politics after the bizarre ring-stealing scandal, which he later sort of confessed to and said was part of his bipolar diagnosis. And I think we have a much better... I hope we have a much better willingness to accept politicians with mental health issues than perhaps 20 years ago.
Mm. One would like to think so, anyways.
I don't really have a good segue
for
this.
There's no good segues for any of these.
So we're just going to pivot right over to Quebec and the results of their recent election, where the cat came out ahead.
Yeah.
Probably brutally mispronouncing even that, or mispronounced.
An acronym, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't want to try to weigh in on Quebec politics too much because...
Well, we're Anglophones on the far side of the country.
You inevitably get yelled
nothing.
At for it. What is interesting for me, though, is this is another election where a Liberal Party has lost. Like, the Liberals lost in BC, although that's a weird case. New Brunswick, to some extent. Ontario, and now Quebec.
And they lost big, too. Like, this is... I think I heard their worst showing since Confederation.
And the same happened in Ontario. So the Trudeau Liberals are losing friends and allies.
Yeah, and I think it's not just that. It's like the Liberal parties are not doing well and doing historically bad in some ways. And I don't know if it's a sign that kind of the old parties are fracturing or not having the pull they used to.
I mean, to some extent, liberalism eventually runs out of ideas, or it's just kind of trying not to be too far left or too far right, and that inevitably gets boring. And there are times when people look for boring, but there are other times when you're like, inspire me so I come out and vote. And well, reactionaries and populists of all sides are more inspiring in different ways than, hey, I will keep taxes at a moderate rate and fund social services slightly more.
The Liberals, or at least federally, usually have a better, more inspirational message than that. So,
and Trudeau definitely did.
I don't think it's that liberalism is boring, although it certainly can be. It just seems to be the age of political disruption. And hey, if you're an upstart party, it's like it's a good time to be one, but it's also kind of interesting and in some ways concerning as well.
Well, it was worth noting the Parti Québécois also collapsed in that election, and Quebec Solidaire leapfrogged them, even though they got in the same range of vote percentage. I guess the other interesting thing to watch for British Columbia is all of the opposition parties in Quebec, everyone except the Liberals had said, if we get elected, we will just institute proportional representation. And it sounds like Legault, the new premier, is still planning to bring forward a bill to do that. He's also talking about invoking the notwithstanding clause left, right, and center, because that's a new normal. But it could be interesting to see two of Canada's largest provinces go to PR possibly in the next year.
Yeah, that has me kind of wondering if, and I mean, I doubt they would do it because once you've had the referendum, sort of voters have had their say. But Attorney General David Eby has pointed out that the government is not required to have a referendum to change our voting system. The Liberals make a big deal out of, you know, the significance out of shifting the way that our democracy works and that it is very important that voters have a say in that. But the government doesn't have to do that. They can just write a bill and change it if they want to.
Yeah, they did it in the past to keep the CCF out right after the war.
And like, in general, I think it's actually a pretty good norm for the reasons that was just described. But yeah, it is a norm, not a legal requirement.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons being, you know, voters have a say not to just keep the CCF out. That's just a side benefit.
Well, and because what happened in the end was social credit swept a victory because no one wanted the other guys. And then social credit just changed the system again. And, you know, once you make that norm of arbitrarily changing the voting system, apparently anyone can do it.
Yeah, I really wouldn't want to get into that pattern of like switching back and forth. But I mean, it does seem like most governments who promise electoral reform and then get elected seem to lose their taste for it very quickly after coming to power. So be interesting to see if Quebec does move in that direction as well.
Yeah, it's weird how that works.
Well, and the last thing we want to leave off with, unless you had any other stories you wanted to squeeze in, Shannon?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I like that you picked up Rob's tweet. That's funny.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm just going to get in here for sort of throwback best of BC Poly. But Rob Shaw _VanSun tweeted out earlier this week that he was in an interview with John Horgan in his legislature office and the phone rang on his desk. The premier says that line has never rang before. Multiple staffers converge on mysterious ringing direct line to the premier. Someone answers it and it's a fake Canada Revenue Agency scam caller. So have you been in the premier's office?
I have been in the premier's office.
And you've seen this phone, right?
I have seen a phone. I do not know if it is the phone in particular. I've only been in the premier's office once when we did the year-end interviews in December. So I did not spend a ton of time sort of examining it. What I think is funny is that we have a main line to the BC Press Gallery. Most of us use our cell phones to take calls. But if someone is trying to reach you at the press gallery, there is a number they can call. And I would say probably about 3/4 of the time when it rings, it's a CRA scam or Google like surveying us or asking us for something. So there's a lot of like, hello, and then like, oh my God, and then just hanging up the phone immediately after.
Well, I'd like to imagine that this is just like an old rotary phone that's just had a layer of dust caked over it.
Maybe bright red and like sitting on a pedestal type table in a corner.
He was worried it was like the direct line to the Kremlin or something.
Yeah. This...
Or Alberta's premier office so they can negotiate over the wine war.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us once again. Shannon, why don't you plug where people can find you on the internet if they want to find you?
Yeah, so if you are interested in my play-by-play QP coverage and sort of everything that goes on a daily basis on the legislature, you can follow me at BC Today Official on Twitter. If you are also interested in pictures of my cat, and as Ian has described it, feminist hot takes, you can follow me at So Bitter So Sweet.
All right. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that has been Politos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Thanks for listening.